Hi everyone, good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Tonight I'm really excited to talk about the questions that you have, and there were a lot of pre-submitted questions in. So if you have questions that you want me to answer live, please submit those throughout the broadcast at any time. And Alex, who's moderating for me this evening, will pass those on to me. And before we get to those live questions, I'm going to answer the pre-submitted questions. So let's get right to it. How do you advise a young adult age 25 explain his month-long absence from the workforce when applying for a job? I mean, you can be very vague. You can talk about, you know, studying a far away, some kind of educational leadership experience. I know people have used that as an example, that they went for an outdoor leadership experience. And there's truth in that, right? That's a true aspect of what we do, is teach people about self and leadership and communication. And the deeper level, depending upon what kind of a job you have, if it's a job that has what you believe to be a compassionate culture, you can be more and more honest about what it is. You can talk about that I went away to get some help, that I went away to work on some issues, and I went to an outdoor experience with a group to work on myself. And you get to decide where along that continuum you speak. You can be as vague as you want, or you can be as specific as you want. And of course, I know for me, and I might be an exception to the rule, I value when people go away. And a lot of people that go away to rehab for existence or for treatment talk about it in public. And so that's something for you and your 25-year-old to work out, and you can keep it to the vague all the way to the specific. It's my experience. And it's probably the water that I've been swimming in for 25 years, that it takes a great deal of courage to ask for help and to be honest with yourself enough to say that you need help. So in that respect, a lot of times that's going to add, for me, an advantage, a leg up when compared to other people. And I'll share this small little anecdote. A lot of clients and students in the past have actually used their Evoke Wilderness Therapy experience as something they would write about on their college essay. I know when I got into a college, and I got into a very, very conservative college. In fact, one of the most conservative colleges in the United States. And I talked about my struggles and my stint at treatment when I was a teenager, leading up to my young adulthood. And the person who responded told me that they didn't let me in spite of that experience. They let me in part because of that experience, and because they saw a maturity in me processing that experience with them. So you get to decide. You can keep it vague if you want, but in a lot of cases, it can be much more honest. And in the big picture, I'm not talking about experiences at Starbucks as serving coffee, but if you're talking about a career kind of position, you want to think about, do I want to be in a culture that doesn't recognize that kind of courage and that kind of growth? So that's a question for your son or daughter to ask themselves. How can family members, immediate and extended, help the young adult sustain the gains he has made at Evoke? You know, that's a common question for siblings and for others. The best way I think you can support them is learn a little bit about what they're learning about. You know, invite family members to some of the podcasts or the webinars that you've really appreciated. Ask them to read something that your son or daughter is reading, or something that you've read. The more that they can step into the child's world, young adult or adolescent child, the more they can step into their world and be open, even vulnerable ideally, the better it is. The client or the student at Evoke doesn't want to be the only project, right? They don't want to be the only person that's vulnerable, that needs help. And so the more people around them can be open and vulnerable to the process, learning, at least learning, and ideally going to a deeper level and saying, gosh, I really got a lot out of that book, or I listened to a couple of podcasts and I got a lot out of it and started looking at myself and realizing I could learn and grow from this. That's the best way, is join on a parallel journey with them as much as possible, right? That's ideal. Join on some kind of, it doesn't have to be to the depth and breadth, perhaps, that the Evoke graduate is going through and will be going through, but it would be nice for them not to be alone on this journey. That's the best thing. If nothing else, stepping into a little bit of that outside of your comfort zone, you'll have some sense of the vulnerability that the Evoke client has experienced, right? If it's uncomfortable for you, if you don't think you need it, you know, those are the same kinds of sentiments that the Evoke client and student have expressed, right? I'm uncomfortable. I don't really need this. And so if nothing else, you'll have an appreciation for what they've been asked to go through. Walking into an Al-Anon, a CODA meeting, even an AA meeting, can be fantastic examples of trying something like what they've tried, learning what they're learning. Open yourself up as much as possible to your own process as you do it. That would be helpful. What percentage of time is Evoke accurate in assessing the readiness of clients to transition out of wilderness, i.e. the client just says what the therapist wants to hear so he can leave the program? It's a great question. I mean, the first answer is we're accustomed to clients and students who are capable of saying the right things. Oftentimes, not always, but Evoke Wilderness Therapy is not the first intervention, right? We're oftentimes a really good fit for somebody who's therapy savvy, for somebody who's had outpatient or other traditional therapies, and it hasn't really taken hold for them. So in that respect, this is kind of the question that I think leads to people sending their child to Evoke, is give them an experience. You know, having said that, I often ask a parent, there's a paradigm shift here that I want to invite you into with this question. What if your child leaves the program and stumbles, falls, relapses, regresses? Does that mean it was the wrong time? Not necessarily. Sometimes that's a part of the process. Sometimes I think in many cases, in those kinds of cases where they regress or relapse, they actually believed that they were ready. And so if we simply measure their readiness by the kinds of success afterwards, I don't think we see the full picture. I ask parents all the time, how will you know a year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, if you made the right decision? And common questions are they'll be doing well in certain ways in their life. And of course, that's a wonderful, very desired outcome. But part of it is a process. Part of it is, you know, what do we learn? We send them to this really powerful, dynamic, insulated intervention, and eventually they have to see if they have legs for it afterwards. When my son was leaving wilderness, I wasn't in any case thinking that he was done. I didn't think that at all. When we were talking about length of stay or aftercare or next steps, when I was ready for him to come home, I didn't have any idea that he was cooked fully. But I thought we had shifted the context, shifted the trajectory, built a bridge between the two of us, and in part, I was ready for the battle. Right? I was ready for the day-to-day struggle that you're insulated from in wilderness therapy and subsequent care. And so it wasn't a perfectly smooth after-treatment process for my son, but it laid the groundwork where eventually, in middle adolescence, he turned it around. Because those tools, those experiences, that work we had done together began to sprout in the experience, later becoming one of our field staff and now in his first semester of graduate school. So it's thinking about it in terms of outcomes can be too simplistic. So I don't have conversations with parents that say he's done. I talk about the pros and cons, where we're at, what we tried to accomplish. Is this intervention at a point of diminishing returns? Are we ready? Is your son, is your family ready for the challenge of the next step? Are you feeling too vulnerable that if there is a setback or is a relapse or is regression, then all is lost and we're back at square one? If that's your level of vulnerability, then maybe you're not ready for the next step. Right? Holding on tightly to the steering wheel, crossing your fingers, hoping that we don't have any of those. That can be a predictor of the greatest kinds of challenges ahead. So it's a different kind of question. And when I'm giving an update to my families, I don't talk about it in simplistic, they're ready or they're not. I mean, I might use that shorthand to describe the situation, but we'll spend some time pulling that apart and talking about what that means. Our family initially looked at wilderness as a stopgap measure, a place to place our teen while we figured out what would be next for him. We have come to realize it's a critical part of his therapeutic journey, but it's hard to understand or articulate why. If a person, in this case a teen, suffering depression embarks on a therapeutic journey towards an understanding of themselves and improved mental health, why do you think wilderness is such an important piece of that journey? In other words, what does wilderness add that other therapies cannot? For example, working with your child as an outpatient so they can remain at home. That's a big question. I would refer you to the webinar on where I talk about the efficacy of wilderness therapy and the nomadic model, the primitive living nomadic model, because I spent a whole hour talking about what wilderness therapy does, but I'll hit some of the highlights. It's a different context, and contexts matter. New contexts are in some ways the only way that we can see the context that we're in. Right? I quote an author who says, in my book, I quote somebody who says, the fish is the last one to discover water. So wilderness is such a different context. The experiential aspect of it adds to access and treatment and healing of things that are unconscious or preconscious. And not just the experience of hiking and camping, while those are important aspects, but also the small communal group living, right? All of that adds. There's nowhere to escape the trials and challenges of wilderness primitive living. So the context is very different. Even for myself right now, my son went on a 30-day wilderness trek this summer, still on that trek, coming home this Saturday, my younger son. And we had done outpatient therapy before with some of his challenges, but I can't tell you how quickly the quality of conversation changed from all those outpatient experiences. And I'm not sitting here thinking everything is cured, there will be no problems, that I take everything he says in his letters at face value, but the depth, the breadth, the level of discourse is dramatically improved. Right? The lessons are cemented and reinforced in the primitive living trek experience that he's going through. In his case, it's in another country. So those are some of the answers. Again, I would encourage you to go to the recent, maybe a few months back, podcast webinar where I talk about the efficacy, right? What wilderness, primitive living, nomadic therapy is and how it works and why it's effective. I'm looking for ways to understand, another parent says, why wilderness works as a piece, but not all, of a therapeutic journey. A wonderful compliment to the next question. Because while wilderness is dynamic, provocative, why wilderness is impactful, dramatic, while it does the things that I just described, some kind of support afterwards is important. Let me go further to say this. I run therapeutic intensives for individuals and families, right? Adults, any kind of adult, and also families. And many people talk about how absolutely powerful and profound those experiences are. But let me be clear. And I'm talking about parents of students. If there's not follow-up, if there's not an aftercare plan of some kind, the returns or the maintenance of the gains that were realized is going to be limited. I will attest dramatically, passionately, to the intensives that I've participated in. And I've been to about 7 or 8 so far myself as a client. The first one dating back to 2010. But all along, I've been going to my own personal therapy. So it's because you never arrive. It's because support is important to maintain, to reinforce, to digest, to remind one of the gains that are made. And the more challenges there are, like with some of our students and clients, the more need there is, the more that structure and support is going to be. So I haven't been in residential treatment since my intensives, but I've been to a lot of therapy, and I go to an intensive every year, along with weekly therapy. What about a daughter who has always dressed as a boy, but won't discuss it with me? She doesn't yet seem attracted to either gender at age 16. She has friends of both genders and seems socially active. What a wonderful question. I think it's important to ask a few questions. Is there something that you're doing that makes it scary to talk to you? Do you have an agenda? Is it your need that is being addressed here, right? You need them to talk to you, so you need to know. I know with a lot of people that are dealing with transgender, with same-sex attraction, that other people's problems, questions with them aren't theirs, right? If you're confused, if you're in the dark, they would say, a lot of them would say, that's not my problem, that's your problem. So ask yourself, is there something you're doing that's not safe? And ask yourself whose need it is. You know, ideally you communicate an openness, a support, a structure, an invitation, and then you let go of the agenda. Prying them open, right? Knocking down their wall to get inside because you feel anxious, that's not going to make them feel safe. You know, the old adage of it's not appropriate to out somebody of their closet, to out somebody else, right? That a person comes out of the closet, their closet, when they're ready, it goes along with this. She might not be ready. Make yourself safe. Provide a welcoming invitation for the kind of discussion, and then make sure that you're managing your anxiety and you don't make them responsible for it. They don't need to clarify things to you so that you feel comfortable. You know, in my own experience having a transgender child, it's been a practice to hold very lightly and to not really give a lot of value to the sexual attraction, to which gender, to which identity, right? I have to change my construct, right? From, you know, what gender you are and who you're attracted to is fundamentally important at a primary level in defining yourself, to, you know, it's your journey. It's your process. And my need for it to fit into certain categories and timelines is, you know, where I came from, but may or may not be true for you. Additionally, a parent asks, can you offer suggestions for families who are at home feeling guilty for sending their child away for therapies? Ways for family members to cope with missing their sibling or child, and ways to help fill the absence or quiet that comes with comes a bit of relief, but also a bit of a hole that the sick member leaves behind, as they weren't always sick and were sometimes, even in their sickness, still the joyous, goofy, sweet child that they were before the illness took hold. There's a couple of resources here. There's a blog by a parent, and there's also a webinar broadcast link that you can take a picture of, take a screenshot of, and later log on to if you're looking at the slide. And there are podcasts I've done on parental grief. Part of it is talking to others who have been on this journey, who are farther along, asking them. I mean, that's why we started the mentor program at Evoke, is so that you could talk to other people during the early vulnerable pieces of your journey and learn and get comfort from them. I think in some ways, that's the best source of comfort compared to somebody who's a professional, right? Although I've been through the process a couple of times now. It's also something that I do professionally. And so talking to a peer can be very helpful. So talk to your mentor. Go to parent support groups. You know, I have a different perspective having worked as a professional in this field. But even recently when we decided to send my son on this trek for the summer, leading up to it, there was some anxious anticipation, some doubt and question. And of course, after a few weeks, we looked at each other and said, my wife and I looked at each other and said, isn't it amazing how obvious this is now? How perfect the intervention seems right now, and how early on we didn't know. So I get it. Even working in this field for 23 years plus, I still can empathize with the trepidation, the hole, the loss, the grief. All of that is real. So talk to others. Share it. Talk to people that can listen, that understand. You have to surround yourself with those kinds of people. Look at some of the podcasts and webinars that talk about this kind of thing. Look at this blog that is posted on the screen from another parent. I also wrote a blog about, will my child forgive me? Look at my blogs and look that one up, because that speaks to some of the guilt. You know, guilt is an insidious part of our lives. Guilt tells us to do the wrong thing as often as it tells us to do the right thing. Guilt is not a reliable source of moral authority. Many, many, many parents, the majority of parents, who tell me that at times, in certain situations, they knew the right thing to do and didn't do it. When I asked them, why didn't you do it? They said, because of guilt, right? We're wired from our own childhood to believe that when somebody's upset, it's our fault, it's our problem, we did something wrong. So we carry that wiring, because that's how our parents raised us, into our parenting. So when our child is upset with us, when our child is hurting or struggling, and part of it is, right? Part of it is just the aspect of being a mother or a father, right? It's how we're wired. It's how we protect our children from serious harm. So you combine all of that and we start to get confused about what's the best thing. The healthiest thing that we can do for ourselves and for our children. So those are some of my thoughts about that. All right, I'm happy to take any live questions. The first question is, how much experience does Evoke have with computer game addiction? How does game addiction differ from other addictions? And is there a different treatment plan for computer game addiction? Some groups actually specialize in it for many, many, many years. So it's very common. And a lot of the groups that specialize in general addiction, including game addiction, process addiction is what this is called. There are very parallel tracks, right? Sex addiction, gaming addiction, gambling addiction, all of those are process addiction. You're not ingesting a substance. And so there's an extraordinary amount of overlap. Some addictions are very difficult, like food addictions, because you actually need food to live. And sex is a part of a healthy life and full life. And playing games is okay, and being on the internet is okay. So in 90%, somewhere between 80 and 90%, the treatment plan and the process is the same. If you were to go to a gambling addiction 12-step meeting, a GA meeting, you would hear the same steps, the same process. If you were to go to a treatment center that only treated addiction, many of the people that had process addictions would be in the same classes, the same groups, the same experiences. So most of it's the same. And then there are unique aspects. We don't need opiates to live. We don't need alcohol or cocaine to live, right? And those things can be immediately deadly. And the physiological addictive aspect of it is unique and so forth and so on. But often the brain, the wiring, most addicts, most who identify as addicts, don't limit it to drugs and alcohol. They know. Talk to people who are going to AA and NA, who are in recovery from addiction, from substance abuse addiction, and they will tell you, I'm prone to all kinds of addictions. So there's much, much more that they have in common than that they are different. And we have a tremendous amount of decades of experience in working with it amongst our therapists. My son attended Evoke for 4 months and is now in aftercare. He has a profile not unlike the shooter in Florida, who also spent 4 months in Utah in a Utah wilderness program. My son turns 18 in January. He still believes he can play video games moderately when he gets out of aftercare. How do you suggest we address his desire for access to video games and relapse to addiction if it occurs after he's 18? You know, these experiences are frightening when we have these well-publicized news events. And like this parent says, there was the shooter at the gaming convention or the gaming event in Jacksonville had spent time, not in our wilderness therapy program, but in another one as part of his treatment earlier in life. And so first I want to reassure you a little bit that program, and we have dealt with tens of thousands, between us probably over 100,000 clients. And those who commit this kind of act are a minuscule percent. So a little bit is to kind of manage the anxiety and not project too much. But you ask a fair question. And what I would suggest is you have clear boundaries. You have clear statements about your truth, but you don't get into a power struggle. And it's too complicated of a question to answer all of the ins and outs of, but keep your boundaries clear, work on your codependency, don't make his project your project, and leave the lines of communication open, right? If your anxiety is too high, if you project too much out in the future, you're not safe for him to talk to. I refer people to this TED Talk often, but go look at the TED Talk. Just Google addiction and Rat Park. RATPARK. Addiction and Rat Park. And watch the TED Talk that comes up at the top. It'll have millions of views, many, many, many millions of views. And they talk about how an antidote, right, a mitigating factor for addiction is connection with loved ones, connection with somebody. And if our anxiety, if our fear prevents that connection because we're too triggered by our child's potential relapse or how they match up, we don't become a resource, right? We want to be their first call. We want somebody they can talk to, and we want to be able to contain them, right? Hold them with patience and curiosity. And so that's why I always say, go make sure you're taking care of your anxiety, your fear, somewhere else, in an Al-Anon meeting or in therapy. So when you're with your child talking, you're not freaked out. Because if you're freaked out, if you're trying to control it, you're not a safe connection for them. So look at the TED Talk. Again, Google TED Talk, addiction, connection, and Rat Park. TED Talk, addiction, connection, and Rat Park. How do you all suggest initiating conversation as a sibling about Evoke after she comes back home? Great question. Ask questions, be a student. I assume you're a sibling or you're asking for on behalf of a sibling. I'll tell you a story. I had a client one time, young adult client, whose sibling was going to visit them for the first time. And at a follow-up school program. So they called me, got permission from the parents, and then called me. And they said, I don't want to mess up. I don't want to set him back, right? I don't want to be a problem. I want to be a support. and I'm really afraid I'm not going to say the right thing because I haven't been involved in all the therapy. What do you suggest? And I said, just tell him that you're afraid and anxious. Tell him exactly what you just told me. What a gift that would be for him not to be the one who doesn't know something for once, because you're kind of the one that's got it all together for the most part. He talks about you in that way. So if you can show up vulnerable, asking questions, being a student, sharing your anxiety, sharing your not knowing, letting him teach you, what a fantastic gift for him. So show up as a student, show up with authentic trepidation if you have it, ask questions, be a student, be as open and vulnerable as possible. Our therapist reports that our son is doing really well and working very hard in the wilderness. He's about to achieve air phase. Does this position him for a better chance of success post-evoke? It tells you that he has some resources. It tells you that he has the capacity to, within a structured system, do well. But air phase is a double-edged sword, right? When we created our curriculum 20 years ago, we purposely created it so that most students wouldn't achieve air phase. Right? Partly because we wanted them to experience that they weren't done. Right? About one out of seven or eight of my clients, maybe one out of eight clients of mine, would get to air phase. And honestly, it was more of a challenge than it was a reward, because they had to guard against internalizing that as, I'm done. I've arrived. I've done my work. So it illustrates that your son or daughter has resources, capacities, strengths, abilities to do well. It also presents a challenge. You know, there are some clients and students who can't even fake it. I used to have clients that were really struggling to say to me, well, I could fake it. And I would say to some of them, do it. Just do it for 3 days. You know? Go along with the program for 3 or 4 days, and they couldn't. So to those parents whose children can do well, it doesn't mean everything. It's not an absolute predictor and guarantee of success, but it tells you that they have resources. It tells you that they can run fast, that they can swim fast. It tells you of their capacity, but that there's oftentimes just as much work for them going forward as anybody else. You advise to talk to other people and lean on our community. At the same time, we're given the guidance to let our child tell their own story and respect their ownership of that narrative. That, in essence, isolates many of us from our social community and with whom we're closest. I don't get the same type of comfort and support from a support group of strangers. How do you reconcile these two pieces of guidance? Fantastic question. First of all, you could have that discussion with your child and see who they're comfortable with. That's number one. Number two, it's also your story. That's why some Al-Anon groups, that's why some, the parent support groups that we run, the parent workshops that we have, are a place to meet with people who've had similar stories. I don't think you should be held hostage and not be able to tell your story. I don't believe in that advice. I don't. And if I was going to any kind of support group, a therapist, a parent meeting, an Al-Anon meeting, a CODA meeting, a Families Anonymous meeting, and I was told I wasn't allowed to because I was betraying my child's confidence, right? I could keep some of the details. I could keep some of those private. But if I was told that, I wouldn't be held hostage by that. I don't know that anybody would. The last thing I'll say is sometimes check with your child, talk to them about it. I believe that if your child is really anxious about you talking to anybody, I believe that there's shame in that, right? Obviously. Now, you shouldn't out anybody else, but I would have a discussion about the shame. In our family, I talk about the fact that I go to therapy, that I go to intensives, that I went to treatment as a teenager. My children who have been to treatment tell me that I can talk about it as much as I... There's a culture in our family that it's just what healthy people do. It's what people who are working on themselves do, and everybody struggles. And the people who are really struggling are the ones who don't seek help, are the ones who imagine that they're sane, who imagine they don't need therapy. And so in some ways, this process can be a very big shift in culture. So of course, check with your child, talk to your child's therapist, address the shame in the family and in the system and in the culture. Find people. I don't have the experience, by the way, so it's rare that I don't have the experience that talking to strangers who have been through this, that people get less support from family members. I most of the time hear the exact opposite. Talking to family members who haven't been through it, that they're less likely to understand, less likely to empathize, less likely to offer comforting words instead of advice or judgments, even though it's cloaked in kindness and love. So I don't have that experience. So those are just my thoughts about it. I, as you know, from my book and from my work and from my podcasts, I don't see a need to build walls between us all. We all are the deep underbelly. You know, everybody's underbelly looks the same. That's just my perspective. All right. Looks like there are no new. I'll go over some upcoming events and announcements, and then I'll have a moment if any follow-up questions come. Like I was just alluding to, we ask all parents to attend 6 12-step support groups while their child is with us. If you want, if you're a family member, extended sibling, you're welcome to do that also. The more, the merrier. Learn what it's like to walk into a room and to be scared, if nothing else. But deeper than that, listen to people who have navigated the waters where a loved one is struggling and see how they deal with it, how they've developed a new kind of sensibility. You can also go to NAMI.org. Find free classes and resources in your area. All of these broadcasts are available on the podcast app on your iPhone. Just search Evoke Therapy Programs. If you have an Android device, you can download the SoundCloud app. And if you're on a computer, you can go to soundcloud.com and search Evoke Therapy Programs. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for new content every day. At Evoke Therapy, follow us on Facebook by searching Evoke Therapy Programs. Find the Evoke Family Foundation on Facebook if you want to become involved in an organization to help people that can't afford treatment. And then, of course, our Evoke Therapy blog for upcoming content. My book is The Journey of the Heroic Parent on Amazon. We invite all parents, if possible, to come to a multifamily therapy experiential workshop at one of our sites. The next one is in our Oregon program at Cascades, September 22nd and 23rd. Contact Melanie at evoketherapy.com for more information or to RSVP. If you want to do a deep dive into your own work, this is, my opinion, the greatest thing that you can do to support your child. And in my opinion, it's a valuable part of my life. You can come to our Finding You experience. October 17th through 21st is the next one. Also, we have private family intensives, custom intensives for families and couples. Our parent support groups, the upcoming ones, New York City will be there Monday, September 10th. I have an asterisk there because I just want to apologize. We scheduled this on Rosh Hashanah. My assistant who does the booking did not look at the calendar, the Jewish calendar. I apologize profusely. And we've recommitted to giving feedback to not make that mistake again. So for our Jewish families who are going to be celebrating Rosh Hashanah, I apologize profusely. We were thinking about canceling it all together, but we have some that are coming. We have several that have RSVP'd. We'll be in New York City at CUNY on Monday, September 10th. I will be in Birmingham, Alabama, the last weekend in October. In Chicago on Tuesday, November 6th. In Philadelphia, Wednesday, November 14th. Email Melanie at evoketherapy.com for more information or to RSVP to any of these. Evoke also has pursuits trips, adventure trips that are scheduled. International, that's what my child is on right now, is a pursuits trip. So if you want to do that with as a family or a young adult, think therapy light, sober fun, challenge, adventure. It's a wonderful process. Any other live questions? What are three books you recommend while our son is a vote? Well, my three favorite books, not counting mine, Parenting from the Inside Out by Siegel and Hartzell, The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice Miller. I like The Dance of Anger by Harriet Lerner. It says it's for women, but I think it's great about setting boundaries. It's my favorite book about setting boundaries. If you want another book, I would say The Anatomy of Peace. So I guess that's five counting my book, The Journey of the Heroic Parent. That's what jumps out to me. All right, folks, thank you for joining us. Thanks for your questions. Thanks for your participation. Thank you for and on behalf of your children of your willingness to do your own work, to look, to learn, to be open to the process. That's, again, the great gift that you can give to them. Have a great week. I will schedule the next broadcast as soon as possible. Take care. Have a safe holiday weekend. Bye-bye.